Okay, this is sound roll 23 for Fight in the Fields, a Paradigm production, and we have a minus 8 dB reference tone to follow on the modulometer, which equals 0 VU. Okay, it's now the 16th of July. We're about to interview Bert Corona. We're still in Los Angeles. We'll be starting camera roll 48. Our first take will be take one.
Like a total blank here.
Right.
Speed.
By and large.
Marker.
Rolling.
Marker, take one.
Now, Bert, you have quite a long trajectory in terms of many different areas, immigration and agricultural organizing, that kind of thing. And so I'm going to cover a large area here. But first of all, what is your recollection on significant attempts to organize farm labor prior to the 50s and 60s? What went on there? Anything significant?
Well, in 1937, I was active in two movements. One, the CIO organizing in Southern California, and the other one, the formation of the Mexican American Youth Movement, which was starting about that time. And in both, there were very significant coincidences that the youngsters who were going to high school and community colleges, at that time they were called junior colleges, were, for the most part, sons and daughters of farm workers who had been trying to organize in Orange County and San Bernardino and in parts of Los Angeles County to organize agricultural workers whose fathers were active. And of course, then their children were the ones who were most likely to finish high school and try to go on to college. And I recall strikes in and efforts to organize in Orange County around Westminster and outside of Anaheim, places like that, where they invoked the criminal syndicalism laws, which was a threat, and more than a threat, it became a very powerful tool in the hands of growers, because actually men or women who tried to organize farm workers could be sent to jail. There was such a thing as criminal syndicalism. Syndicalism means unionizing. And so interwoven with the lives of these young people to finish just a very incipient higher education were the struggles of their parents in those towns of Orange County and southern Los Angeles County, San Bernardino, and Riverside, where there was orange growing operations.
But beyond these laws, what were the other obstacles to organizing agricultural labor?
Well, the other obstacles, of course, had always been removal. If you've seen the shots of the Corcoran strike, where they packed up the strikers in trucks and just took them to the nearest railroad head and loaded them up in boxcars heading back to Texas. Removal, deportation to Mexico. In fact, some of those Southern California judges still, we have had cases where a person has been arrested for driving under the influence a couple of times or has been involved in a wreck or two and is not insured, where the judges order the person to leave or I will deport you from this county. They still are thinking in those terms, you know. And Peter Shea, who heads up the Coalition for Human Rights and Constitutional Liberties, he's had cases where he's had to go and defend people in counties like King County and north of that, in Lindsay, Porterville, places like that, and really enlighten the judges in terms of California cannot deport people out of its boundaries. And then in the same period of time, we saw the start again of organizing packing shed workers and cannery workers, primarily by the United Cannery Agricultural and Packing Workers of America, a union that was formed in those years, 36, 37, 38. In the South, a professor by the name of Leon Henderson was one of the organizers. They organized tobacco and sugarcane and cotton field workers in the South. And then they came out here and tried to organize cannery and packing sheds. Not necessarily picking as such, but the shed would be organized, and that would bring in also those who did the picking of the vegetables to bring to the sheds. And very much involved in that, of course, was Luisa Moreno, a woman organizer. I don't know if you've had, have you had material on her? We have her life pre-United States life. We have an album of her activities in Mexico and Guatemala.
But I want to get into kind of into this legal framework. I mean, agricultural workers were always excluded from labor organizing.
Oh, sure.
They weren't included into the National Labor Relations Act. Why?
Because of the power of Western Federation of Growers, Western Association of Growers, and powerful interests in agriculture that were very closely linked to a railroad. So the big railroads that had long lines into California also supported the growers' efforts to keep unions out of the fields. And the big canners, Libby and Swift, and all kinds of cannery operations, Del Monte, CalPac, Rosenberg, all those played Hunts, Wesson Oil, the Norton family. All those forces were very active in processing food grown in California. And so they were very much interested in keeping the fields unorganized, thus keeping the packing sheds unorganized and the canneries. But Luisa Moreno did finally succeed in organizing 90 canneries in Northern California before she had to leave for Mexico.
Now, this was earlier, but let's say in the 1960s, what was there a particular, something going on in the 60s?
In the 60s,
that actually made it more possible?
There were efforts in the 60s. Of course, the United Farm Workers had formed the National Association of Farm Workers, the NAFW. But there was the AWOC, Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, that was formed by the AFL. With forces from other unions who came to California and joined with Larry Itlong and the Filipino Workers Union, and with vestiges of the old unions in Stockton and other cities where there were large packing and canning operations that were organized by the Longshoremen's Union. The Longshoremen, remember, had a long history of organizing canneries and packing workers here and in Hawaii. And so in early 60s, that was what was going on. The Filipinos were moving and organizing, and the AWOC were moving and organizing. And Caesar was building the basis for an association that would then lead to a union. He felt that the unions were not able to really mobilize intelligently the farm workers that could be organized. And so he felt that there was a step that they had to take in terms of maturing and development and sophistication of how organization could be used. There was also the tremendous threat of violence that was always heaped upon efforts to organize farm workers by the growers themselves. The growers would burn their sheds, would put bombs in their warehouse and so forth, and attribute all this to the workers, and of course they would also foment very super militant voices amongst the ranks, you know, people that felt, oh, we can't win, but let's burn. There's this, you know, there was always that fifth column type of infiltration into efforts, into groups that were trying to organize workers legitimately for peaceful collective bargaining purposes. So Caesar, taking all these things into consideration, the need for preparation, for development, for education, and the need for firmly establishing the concept and the strategy of nonviolence was very important to him. And he felt that there should be a period where workers could be trained and could be developed to think in these terms and to be aware of the dangers of falling prey to fomented violence from within and so forth, that it led to nowhere. And also just a simple question of building unity, you know, around not only just the the need to confront the grower and the packer unitedly, but also united to become more self-sustaining, empowerment, self-empowerment. By participating together, they could obtain many other needs that had to be filled, such as social services, mutual aid assistance, food, clothing, shelter, so forth, medical care. You know, all those needs were very present in the minds of farm workers, and also Caesar thought that it was important to address those needs through the association.
But prior to organizing the fields, Caesar and you were doing a lot of the same stuff in LA and CSO. Could you tell us about that?
Well, however, CSO and there was an organization called ANMA that was active from the unions, from the left-led unions of that time, the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers, from the activities of CIO unions here, the furniture workers. This gentleman that owns a house, Gus Brown, can tell you about his history. Angelina?
Okay, that's the end of Camera 48. We're now going to Camera 49. Our next take will be take two.
I think she's on the phone. Oh, no. No, she's
up. Now she is.
Speed. Rolling.
Marker, take two.
Bert, perhaps you could tell us about the early days at CSO when you first came across Caesar. Mm-hmm. What was going on there? Fred Ross was organizing solids.
Yes.
There. Tell us about that.
The main effort was to try and organize barrios, comunidades, communities, in San Jose, in Oakland, in Salinas, in Los Angeles, in San Diego, in the Imperial Valley, and of course in and around Fresno, and other agricultural towns in central California. Their effort was significant in as much as it sought to involve the people to build an organization that would serve them, defend them, and speak for them. And great efforts were made to train the people on how to organize, how to conduct the organization, which I think was different from what other efforts had been doing in the past, that were primarily efforts at waging the struggle. But the CSO was involved in civic struggles as well, against discrimination in housing, against police brutality, against discrimination in the schools and in employment. And I think that it laid the groundwork for much of what has taken place later on in the building of MAPA. I think that the fact that CSO existed along with ANMA made it possible for MAPA to develop, the Mexican-American Political Association, that by the end of the 60s reached as many as 100 chapters throughout the state.
But where did this philosophy come from, this whole self-empowerment philosophy? Did that come from Saul Alinsky?
I don't think so. No. I think that he had very specific ideas, Alinsky. Alinsky and Fred Ross had specific ideas. Saul had specific ideas about moving people and taking advantage of the weaknesses in the structures that were oppressing Mexican people, such as chambers of commerce, employer associations, the civic leagues of entrepreneurs, and so forth. And he was a good tactician and strategist. I think, though, however, that and Fred Ross was magnificent as an organizer. As a person that could impart and foment and inspire people to move for themselves. But I think that one must attribute also to the history of organization amongst the Mexican and other Spanish-speaking people in the United States and in their home countries. The history that was laid down by movements such as the Flores Magón movement, which from Mexico, the anarcho-syndicalist movement that came into the United States about 1890, when the Magonistas were chased out of Mexico, and they settled in many parts of the United States, Chicago, the far Midwestern steel towns of the Monongahela Valley in Ohio, in Kansas, in Texas, in New Mexico, of course, the whole Southwest. And they struck up a acquaintanceship with other immigrant groups, such as the Hibernia Society, which organized Irish groups, the Central European groups, the Jewish groups, that formed mutual aid societies that could help each other to send the bodies of those who died here, send them back to Mexico. When people got sick, the self-help or mutual aid logias would then come to the aid and give some money, some assistance to the people who were left without a breadwinner, so forth. I think that we have to attribute part of the tactical successes and tactical direction to the strategy of organizing that came, that was enhanced by CSO, enhanced by ANMA, enhanced by MAPA, to also the early history of self-help and self-movement on the part of Mexicanos. The research archives of universities here and some in Mexico are replete with the histories of these efforts by Mexicans to organize in the little towns where they lived, segregated, Jim Crowed, and working at the most menial, most seasonal type of operations in the steel plants, in packing plants throughout the country. Just to cite one source of materials are the, I think, 17 books that Paul Taylor, the professor at UC Berkeley, had his students write in going to summer sessions for their master's degrees and studying in these communities and writing their what they discovered there. And also the histories of the Flores Magón movement in the United States, where they engaged in many strikes, not over wages in many cases, but over treatment. And so there is this history. And even in Mexico now, we're finding out that some of the figures that played a role in the Mexican Revolution had been in the United States organizing sugar beet workers, organizing agricultural, mining workers, railroad workers. It's not as if all of a sudden the CIO came and brought organization skills to the Mexicans. The Mexicans already had them from decades before. So it wasn't as if ANMA brought them or CSO or MAPA, but that really those efforts are historical. Just to lend you just an example, there was a fellow by the name of Refugio Martinez in 1950 who had been organizing back of the yards for 20 years, organizing the workers in Chicago who worked for Armour and Wilson and Swift and Cudahy, lived in terrible and abominable conditions. And he had organization there for all those years. I knew him as far back as 1938 when he came to be a participant in the Mexican and Latino Congress of the Spanish-speaking peoples that was held here in Los Angeles. And Sal Alinsky later on was telling me one day that he was instrumental in building the back of the yards movement amongst the Mexicans and so on and so forth. Well, I didn't want to argue with the man, but I knew as far back as 1938, Refugio Martinez and the Mexicans there had been doing self-help and mutual aid organization, you know, to sustain themselves. And I remember living in El Paso.
I want to lead you back. I want to take you in another direction right now because I want to get back to you.
Okay.
And I want to get back to you and the early days when you first came across
Caesar. Them, yes.
Apparently, you met Caesar in the 50s, and he was just getting started, I guess, here in L.A. with CSO or around that era. I mean, what were your earliest recollections of Caesar and his work as an organizer?
I think I met him in the 40s, late 40s, when he was organizing in San Jose. And over issues, over community issues, and I thought that he was very, very, very brilliant in the fact that he understood that the Mexican people had to be moved, that they had to be mobilized, and that they had to be the ones to take responsibility for what's happening in the communities. They were fighting over housing issues, they were fighting over police brutality, and over discrimination in employment. And the tenacity that he had, the persistence, the faithfulness and indomitable spirit of struggle, and his honesty, that he was not a man for sale to the powers that be in the towns in San Jose. He was not trying to accommodate them, but he was trying to strengthen the people who needed strength. He was trying to improve their organizational skills and levels. That's what struck me very much about Caesar.
Where did he learn those skills, those organizational skills?
Well, I think that he learned them as he went along, because he got into the struggle, and you learn those skills from participating. But I think that he had also been a barrio bato. You know, before Fred Ross ran into him, he was already a leader in the community as such. If you see some of the old pictures where he's even dressed almost like a suitor, you know. He was identified with the strong people in the barrio. With a high moral characteristic, rather than being just destructive as some of the kids were at that time. And I think that Fred Ross was instrumental in strengthening his skills about organizing, going back, and the persistence that Fred Ross inculcated, and that it was a process that had to take place so that you didn't get discouraged because they turned you down when you visited them door to door. And Fred was great in teaching the process so that people would understand that in going to organize door to door and bringing people together, that you had to face divisiveness, you had to face, how shall I put it, an inability to see through the immediate problems that people had, giving them a long-range view, and that's important, and showing people how to be determinant and stubborn about staying with the cause, because a defeat today really meant a victory tomorrow if you stayed with it. And I think that's very important in the life of a young person who is organizing, to know that somebody else has had those experiences, and that those experiences can be explained and can be understood, and so that you take the long-range view. And I think that was the great contribution that Fred Ross gave to Caesar and to everybody that he reached, besides being a very, very competent direct organizer himself.
Okay. Now, John, we should pause. Okay. Are you a role?
Matthew?
We're going to change another role.
Okay.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 49 and the end of the sound roll. Goodbye. On the module number to follow, which equals zero view. Again, this is roll number 24. Here comes tone. Okay, we're continuing the interview with Bert Corona. We're starting camera roll 50, 50, and our next take will be take 3.
Feel free, please.
Can you move the mic now?
Marker, take 3.
Bert, over the 40s, 50s, and 60s, as you knew Caesar, what did you see much growth, much change in him? What was different?
Yes, I saw very, very positive change and growth. I'll just give you an example. Through the period of the 50s, Caesar was organizing in CSO. He had a lot of contacts with people in the Democratic Party, beginning with Governor Pat Brown on down, Alan Cranston, and many of the leadership statewide of the Democratic Party, and even some nationwide. His growth came in terms of the demands of the struggle. I saw this happen when he initiated the march to arrive on Easter Day in Sacramento, initiated a march from San Diego all the way to the state capitol. And there was a lot of criticism heaped upon the CSO and on Caesar, who was now leader of the union, by some unions and many Democratic leaders who felt that Caesar had retrogressed in his understanding of politics, because now he was going to confront the Democratic establishment in Sacramento on this statewide march, pointed to try to force Governor Brown to be in Sacramento and wait and meet with the farm workers and their allies that they had gathered in the course of developing the march. Because if we understand the situation properly historically, this march, although it started out in support of farm workers, became a march of the entire Spanish-speaking people of the state confronting the government, confronting the policies of Pat Brown, confronting the policies of the Democratic establishment, the Democratic Party, in terms of farm worker labor relations, in terms of supporting the boycott, in terms of not bringing in any more braceros. And he was put under a lot of criticism. Many of the conservative trade unionists who had wanted to help him and helped a little bit before, but who had a lot of influence politically, had put a lot of pressure on the farm workers not to carry out that that march.
You think he was right?
Yes, he was. Caesar was right. And he had the courage and he had the boldness, and many people laughed at him, and other people felt that he was making a serious mistake. But Caesar was very determined, and that's, in my estimation, carrying out an old characteristic of his, that once he started on a course, he could be very, very determinative. He could be very strong in his support of the policy and what had to be done. And no matter if they presented almost insurmountable obstacles, if he felt that win or lose, that's what had to be done at that moment to develop the course of the struggle for his cause, he would carry it out. And he did carry it out, even though he wasn't even able to be there because he was still organizing more and more people to come from Stockton. Herman Gallegos had to act as master of ceremonies to receive the people there at the state capitol. But let me tell you, he was really a great success. The farm workers were trying to negotiate something at Sierra Vista at the Seagram ranches, and I was brought in by the Teamsters in San Francisco, a fellow by the name of Goldberger, who used to represent Jimmy Hoffa, and whom we knew in San Francisco. I was living there and organizing at that time, and his men stopped me on the freeway coming in from Oakland, asked me to pull aside and to follow them, that Goldberger wanted to see me. And it was very important. So I followed him. When I got into the Teamster headquarters, they brought me into Mr. Goldberg's office, and he was talking to Jimmy Hoffa. And Jimmy Hoffa was telling him that Cesar Chavez had to pull off the great boycott from the wholesale liquor dealers, liquor warehouses that the Teamsters had organized in San Francisco and up and down the state. And especially with Shenley and the other people that, it was Shenley, not Seagram, the people that produced an awful lot of import liquor. And it seems that some of the, while he was on the march, some of the people who led the great boycott in San Francisco began picketing the organized warehouses that the Teamsters had organized and that were carrying Shenley products, you see.
What did you do when you...
Well, they told me that I better get a hold of Caesar and tell him that he better pull the people off of the boycott and so on and so forth. And I told him I couldn't get a hold of him because I didn't know where he was. He said, well, yes, you know, we started this kind of argument. Well, Caesar was marching on the march. And finally, we were able to convince Jimmy Hoffa that it was not that we were trying to avoid doing it or that Caesar didn't want to respond. But we finally convinced him that Caesar was going to carry out the boycott come what may. So about an hour later, we were in that room, and Jimmy Hoffa called back, and he says, all right, I've got an agreement. If you guys pull the boycott off, I think I can get Shanley to work out an agreement with you people. We're putting a lot of pressure because we can't have this thing spread. It'll destroy the entire fabric of our liquor warehouse organizing in the United States. You see? So Caesar understood that, and Dolores understood that, and they played it, and they got a contract out of that, even as a side benefit from carrying the march on. So see what a brilliant result came. And I had another occasion to see how Caesar grew and developed and understood really fully what he was doing. A lot of people thought that they had to help him because he was not smart enough, that he didn't understand some of these more older politicians and older trade union people could not see how a young person, a Mexican, could give such brilliant leadership in terms of a nationwide labor dispute, because this is what this had become, a nationwide labor dispute. And that was when the farm workers needed support in Delano. The strike was widening, and the United Auto Workers had, through Paul Schrade, begun to support and begun to get close to the union. And they sent out a man who played a very important role at that time, representing Walter Reuther. His name is Henry Santisteban, who now lives in Washington, D.C. And Henry, working through Paul Schrade and Walter Reuther, came to Delano. Some of us had been in Delano there since the strike opened up as volunteer supporters, you know, arms and legs people, to what Caesar was doing. And it was finally announced to Caesar that Walter Reuther and his staff were coming to Delano to look over the situation themselves, to talk to Caesar, to find out what kind of an operation it was, and to see if it warranted giving him the help that Paul Schrade had advocated and some of the other UAW people had advocated to Walter Reuther that the UAW should lend and give so that the farm worker struggle could go on. And so a lot of people came right before Walter Reuther, and they were telling Caesar what to do, how to handle him, that he was pretty shrewd, and so on and so forth. But Caesar listened very calmly, but he had his own plan. He understood the situation better, and when Walter Reuther came, Caesar had organized a parade all over the grape areas that were in the town, from one area to another. And so when Walter showed up with Henry Santisteban and Paul Schrade, we had a march going. And they put him in front of the march, and he participated in this march all through the grape areas of Delano. You know, it was just a marvelous, marvelous idea. When you receive a fellow that you expect to get their support, he could not do but support him. What else could Walter Reuther do? So this is just an example of the kind of great tactician that he was, and how he grew in understanding and in insight as to what he had to do to strengthen his movement and to bring in all the forces that should be brought in, of course, which were the national labor unions involved in handling products that came out of Delano, that came out of the grape fields.
I'm going to change gears here a little bit. Okay, let's stop here. I want to get to the braceros.
Okay.
We're going to get into some sticky issues here with the braceros, deportations,
okay.
And that kind of stuff. Let's stop here.
Okay, that's the end of take 3 and camera 50.
Oh, sorry. Is the panel locked?
I don't think so. I didn't lock it.
What room are we in?
We're in camera 51. Sound camera 24.
One. Yeah, 51.
Okay. Okay, we're now going to camera 51. Our next take will be take 4.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Marker, take 4.
We're going to get into a little bit of a sticky issue here. The whole issue of the braceros and Operation Wetback. I mean, that was a difficult thing for Caesar and his organizing efforts to deal with, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, Caesar's position had always been to support the termination of the Bracero program. And all of us were united on that because it was a horrible exploitation of people who could not organize, they could not fend for themselves, they could not represent themselves, they could not even become involved in doing something for themselves other than stop working, striking. And if they struck, they would be bundled back up in buses and trains and sent back to Mexico. So it was that kind of a situation. So we were all together in the fight to end the Bracero program. The key element in that program was Adam Clayton Powell. Congressman Adam Clayton Powell was chairman of the Labor and Human Resources Committee of the House. He had a lot of seniority. He was the only black congressman, and he was on our side. He did, and the extension of the Bracero program in 1966 had to go to his committee for a due pass on extension. And the only extension that was being requested was really that had hard requests behind it was Stockton tomato growers who wanted 33,000 braceros brought in. We had pretty much, between the farm workers and MAPA and community organization, Caesar's organization and Dolores' activities, we had pretty much killed support for the Bracero program in many states. It was a nationwide campaign, and of course in many parts of California. But now the growers really put on the heat. They wanted these 33,000 because, not that they needed them so much for that crop, but they wanted to continue the Bracero program, and they felt that this is a hard place to put a stop to our efforts to put an end to the Bracero program. And they convinced Governor Brown that they needed those workers, and we put a lot of pressure on Governor Brown, and he wouldn't give in. It was very hard for him to give in because he claimed that he had received a lot of good support on other legislation from the Western Association of Growers. Well, it was up to the committee in Congress, and it was up to the chairman, Adam Clayton Powell, to call the committee in session for purposes of evaluating the Bracero program and the extension of Public Law 78. And they had a majority of his committee already sold on the idea of extension. So he knew if he had a meeting, he would lose. So he took off for the Bahamas. He had his girlfriend, Hazel Scott, the famous pianist, in one of those islands. He spent 2 months over there, and they couldn't get him back into the States. And they were calling for impeachment. The growers put a lot of pressure on him. But he was very adamant, he was very strong, he was stuck to his commitment to us. And so then he called for a meeting to go someplace to Guam or someplace in the Pacific. And he flew and stopped in San Francisco for about an hour on this plane. And he had called us, Chuck White, his representative, legal aid or whatever, legislative representative, he called us together, and we met him at the airport. And we asked him if he was going to stick by his guns and refuse renewal, and he says yes. I remember that Ernie Galarza at that time asked him, what chances do you see in extending the program? He says, over my dead body. So he went, never called a meeting of the committee for that whole year, and that's how the program ended. So we were together, Caesar, farm workers, everybody was together on ending the program. As far as operation, Wetback and everything related to undocumented, Caesar always supported organizing anybody who was there. Many of the active people were people without documents, active in the union in the 60s and 65, 66, and the strikes and so forth. Caesar was not anti the undocumented. I mean, it's been built up as being that as a result of things that were done by the union that were not understood or misinterpreted. During the Coachella strike, when in order to break the strike of the farm workers against the Coachella growers in Indio and Coachella Cathedral City grape-growing areas, the growers resorted very patently to tie in with the immigration service and permit anybody who wanted to come over and work in the strike to cross the border from Mexicali and from San Luis Rio Colorado. It was, I'll tell you, we were working with Caesar. We had leaflets to distribute at the border. MAPA supported the strike 100%, and we had a team down there at the border led by Alfredo Figueroa from the Blythe MAPA chapter. He took 15 men, stationed them at the border with leaflets to give to anybody crossing, not to come and break the strike, not to come and cross the picket lines. They were arrested by order of the Immigration Service, saying that they were obstructing the operations of the Immigration Service on the border. They were jailed by the City Council of Mexicali, of Calexico, for nothing, for really no base allegation could be established. We had to fight that kind of collusion between the city governments and the immigration and the growers.
Weren't there a couple of situations where Caesar actually asked the INS to deport workers who were breaking the strike? Did that ever happen?
Yes, I think that. But I think he did that primarily directing his criticism at the fact that they were breaking a strike, not because they were undocumented. They had been recruited by permission of the Immigration Service by growers to break the strikes. And Caesar always felt that there should be legislation preventing strike breakers to be herded, strike breakers to be contracted, strike breakers to be organized in order to pointedly break a given strike. And it was on that score that he took that action. But there were other people in labor who were anti the organizing of undocumented workers. Even to this day, some unions still do not support the organizing of immigrants for many reasons. Primarily, the reason is that if they organize them and come into those unions, they will bounce these leaders out of office and put in leaders that would be more amenable and more sympathetic to the needs of immigrant workers. And so that's the other angle. Some of the labor leadership is afraid of the total organization of Latino and Hispanic, Mexican workers here in Chicago and New York and the Southwest, because they're the majority now working in those industries, and they will be the majority of the members, and they will vote in their own leadership and vote out some of this old, phony, Anglo-Saxon or European racist type of leadership. That's what the issue is all about. Caesar always supported the organizing of undocumented. That they weren't very enthusiastic about leaving the border wide open is something else during a strike situation. Nobody wanted that to happen, you know. In other words, our organization, we were supporting the right of the undocumented to stay here and to work and to be given rights and to be given visas, not deportation. I mean, that was all our propaganda at that time, Hermandad Mexicana. In the late 60s and the 70s and the 80s. But never, never did we support the issue that they should be also permitted to break strikes. On the contrary, we felt that they should be dealt with as strike breakers and they should pay the consequences of whatever law or whatever public opprobrium should be heaped upon them as strike breakers, not as immigrants. Unfortunately, other forces tied the two together. You know.
I'm going to change gears just a little bit here. Before we get too far, we're going to get into Kennedy.
Sure.
Kennedy. I want to talk a little bit about Dolores.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. She was also a brilliant strategist. Also.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And you know her.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. We've got to include her, sure.
Oh, you wanted to change?
I'm sorry.
Okay, that's the end of Camera Roll 51, and that's the end of the sound roll. Goodbye. Changing sound rolls.
Nice and quiet.